Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit newyorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
This is The Author's Voice, new fiction from The New Yorker. I'm Deborah Treisman, fiction editor at The New Yorker. On this episode of The Author's Voice, we'll hear John Lurie read his story Three Short Moments in a Long Life from the May 9, 2016 issue of the magazine. Lurie is the author of 20 books, including the novels The Miracle and The Medici Boy. His first story in The New Yorker was published in 1980. Now here's John Lurie.
Three Short Moments in a Long Life. 1. The Spy. Beverly LaPlante and I were second graders at New Carew Street School, and we both hated recess. She hated recess, and she cried the whole time, and nobody knew why, so everybody made fun of her. I hated recess because it wasn't really school, and we weren't learning anything. It was a waste of time. I knew Beverly only by name and by what I could tell from spying on her. Her last name was LaPlante, which was strange, and therefore wrong, and she was famous for being a crybaby. She was not even pretty. Her crying all the time frightened me, so I never spoke to her. Besides, I didn't want anybody to think I was her friend. She didn't belong, and secretly, I feared I didn't belong. The nice thing about Beverly LaPlante was that she disappeared sometime that winter. One day, Miss Williams was taking attendance, and after a little pause, she skipped over Beverly's name. We all looked at where she was supposed to be sitting, and her seat was empty. I remember thinking, yes, good, she didn't belong and now she's gone. I wondered if she was crying in her new place, wherever that was. I wondered how she had managed to disappear, or if it was something her mother and father had done to her. I wondered, for the first time, why she cried. Second grade came to a dull close without any further thought about Beverly LaPlante. Third grade started with a bang. We had a new teacher, Miss Connolly, who loved me because I was smart and clean, and I loved her back because she was beautiful. At dinner one night, my mother said to my father, "She's very nice, but dear God, those teeth." "What's with the teeth?" my father said. "She's got buck teeth like a horse." It was only conversation, but it was not nice to Miss Connolly, so I hated them both until I went to bed. We had a new reading book, a thick one with a brown and orange cover, and during recess I hid in the bathroom and read ahead. On my third day of hiding in the bathroom, the janitor caught me and told Miss Connolly, who gave me a lecture about good citizenship. She didn't look beautiful then. She looked like an angry horse, and that made me cry. She gave me a hug and told me that she understood, but I couldn't skip recess anymore. I had to do what everybody else did, so I promised. But I still read ahead in the brown and orange book of stories. In third grade, we played dodgeball during recess. I liked dodgeball because I was good at it. I was skinny and quick, and I could see ahead of time where someone was going to throw the ball, and I'd get out of the way so the ball would hit someone else, someone who was fat or slow. My friend Billy Muir was fat and slow, but he was an exception. He managed to avoid getting hit most of the time. Billy Muir's father always wore a suit. He was successful in business, so he was transferred to the Chicago branch of his company, where he continued to be successful, until his supervisors discovered that he was embezzling money, and he hanged himself with his belt. That was later. In third grade, Billy Muir had no idea that his father would end up famous. Billy was fat and slow, but but he could dodge the ball anyway, so that was something to think about. But the big thing to think about was the new girl. Her name was Beverly, just like the LaPlante girl who had disappeared the winter before. But this new Beverly was pretty, and she laughed all the time. I was the best in class at dodgeball, but on this day I was the first one out, which made me miserable. It was fair, but it was wrong, because I wasn't paying attention and the ball hit me while I was thinking about the Little Mermaid story I was reading, by Hans Christian Andersen, with an E instead of an O. Now that I was out, I began to pay attention to the game. Standing at the edge of the circle, I could get a good look at everybody, and that was when I recognized the new girl. She was pretty, and her hair was short now, and she was a different Beverly LaPlante, but she was Beverly LaPlante all the same. How was this possible? She was wearing a Girl Scout outfit with clumsy Girl Scout shoes. She was talking and laughing and making noise, and when Billy Muir got hit and had to go outside the circle, she noticed the angry face he made, and she said, "Jesus Christ, your face would sour the milk." Nobody seemed to hear her, but I heard her, and I looked at Miss Connolly, who made a horse face, which meant that she had heard her, too. But she didn't say anything. Taking the Lord's name in vain was wrong, and therefore Miss Connolly was wrong to pretend she hadn't heard. But then Joycey Adams got hit by the ball and just stood there like a dummy until everyone yelled at her that she had to leave the circle. She said that it wasn't fair because the ball had barely hit her, and Beverly said, "What the hell? Don't be such a damn crybaby." Everybody heard her this time and turned toward Miss Connolly, who finally said, "Now, now, language, please." They all went quiet, waiting to see what would happen. But Beverly laughed into the silence and said, "Shit, piss, fuck." Miss Connolly said very loudly, "Time for class, people. Everybody to the stairs. Now, not tomorrow." She said, "People," in that special voice, so we all ran to the stairs and waited. Miss Connolly took Beverly aside and we couldn't hear what she said, but Beverly just laughed and said something back. Miss Connolly took Beverly's arm and shook it hard, but Beverly pulled away and ran to the center of the dodgeball circle, where she did a little dance in her Girl Scout shoes, shouting over and over, "Jesus Christ and shit piss fuck! Jesus Christ and shit piss fuck!" She shouted as if she had finally discovered the truth and couldn't wait to tell the world. Miss Connolly herded us up the stairs and into the classroom, where she gave us silent reading time until lunch period. I tried to figure out what had happened at dodgeball, but it just made my head hurt. The bad words were wrong, of course, and taking the Lord's name in vain was wrong, but it was more complicated than that. It was something about Beverly herself. I wondered what had happened to her that made her happy now, but with dirty words, when a year ago she had cried all the time. She wasn't like any of us. She didn't belong. She didn't fit in. I tried all the time to fit in, and no one noticed that I didn't. But now I wondered, secretly, if I was like Beverly LaPlante. I began to think of her when I was supposed to be doing arithmetic and geography, which were no fun anyway. I began to think of her on the walk to school each day, and again on the walk home. Then one night when I said my prayers before bed, I finished up with the sign of the cross, and trying not to say it, I said, "Please God, let Beverly LaPlante die." It was a real prayer, and I knew it was wrong, and I would go to hell. I said, "I take it back." "But you can't take back prayers." I said a lot of Our Fathers, and after a while I felt that maybe I wouldn't go to hell, and I should stop thinking about Beverly. She was just one of the things I was afraid of. I wasn't sure what all the others were, but I knew for certain that I was afraid of Beverly LaPlante. Beverly died that summer of polio. My mother said, "No more swimming at the pond. That's how you get polio. That's how your little friend died, the LaPlante girl, swimming in the pond." So I didn't swim that summer, but I knew then that I would have Beverly LaPlante stuck in my mind forever. In fourth grade, everything was different. There were new people and some of the old people were gone. I began to understand that people disappeared and changed, and sometimes they hanged themselves or came back different and still didn't fit. People were a mystery, I decided, like the resurrection at Sunday school. Jesus died and was buried, and then he rose from the dead. He said hello to Mary Magdalene, She was the first to see him because she had washed his feet and dried them with her hair. And later he made breakfast for his disciples to prove that he had died and then come back again real. There was no crying involved with Jesus, and no dirty words. Then he disappeared for good, just like Beverly LaPlante. To the writer. I was working on my novel, Don't Even Ask, when I heard the doorbell ring. My wife was out teaching school, so I had to answer it myself. I got up from my computer, went downstairs slowly because I'd turned my ankle a few days earlier. And just as I got to the door, I tripped on the new carpet and heard myself saying, "Jesus Christ." I opened the door, and it was him. "Hey," he said. I recognized him immediately from his pictures. He had long blonde hair and those eyes that follow you around the room. My head had been bothering me lately. I figured it was the asthma medications I was taking, but I couldn't believe that they were powerful enough to conjure up a lithographed Jesus at my front door. I'd been meaning for some time to read one of the Gospels straight through, get the story directly from the approved source, so maybe that was it. He was always on my mind these days, and now he was on my porch. "Right," he said. At first I was embarrassed, but after a minute I got over the blonde hair and the eyes, and I could see that he was nothing special, just another guy trying to get along. Maybe he was a vet. Iraq? Afghanistan? Anyway, he had on grungy jeans and an orange sweatshirt, and he could have used a shower. "How's it going?" he said. I was tempted to tell him how it was going. I'd written all these books and nobody gave a shit, and I was in the middle of another one that nobody would give a shit about either. My subject this time, if novels can be said to have a subject, was guilt. It was the story of a high school teacher who was guilty of lots of things: infidelity, verbal cruelty, petty theft, the usual lying and cheating. But he was not guilty of molesting one of his students, and that was what he was accused of. I was trying to use this poor chump to explore the infinite varieties of guilt and justice and injustice. When the doorbell rang, I was working on a scene in which a harmless conversation between this teacher and a student would be overheard by another teacher, a troublemaker, who would later testify that he had witnessed what sounded like a seduction. The scene was too complicated as I had written it, and I was trying to make it simpler without lessening the tension or giving away what would happen. The problem was that I didn't really understand the teacher or his guilt. It seemed that he just didn't fit in. He didn't belong, and I didn't know why. And now I was staring at this guy in an orange sweatshirt who was standing on my porch. "You okay?" he said. "So," I said. He got down to business. He asked if he could help me out in exchange for a meal, and I explained that that wouldn't be possible because I was a writer with an obsession, and there wasn't much help anybody could give me. I nudged the door a little, sort of a hint. He said that his father was a writer, and I said, "Is that so?" And he said, "He never published, though." And I said, "Yes, publishing is hard." I shifted my weight off my sore ankle to let him know that we were done talking. I gave him a hard look, and he looked back. It crossed my mind for a second that he could rob me or kill me, and nobody would ever know. I tried not to show what I was thinking. Finally, he said, "Could I spare a dollar?" There was something proud, or maybe humble, in the way he asked, as if he were owed it, as if I had no choice in the matter. I thought, what the hell, and gave him a five. He could get a latte and a morning bun at Starbucks, I figured, though he didn't look the latte type. I thought about what my wife would do, and I gave him another five. "Have a good day, man," he said, and waved his hand, sort of a combination salute and blessing. "You too," I said, and closed the door. I was halfway up the stairs when I knew I had done the wrong thing. That man was the breakthrough that would have made all the difference in my life. I should have invited him in and given him some coffee, and then simply confessed everything. Everything. But what, exactly? Was it confession I wanted, or some kind of exoneration? I sat down on the stairs to give this some thought. Jesus Christ and shit, piss, fuck. After a while, I went back down and opened the door and looked around. Of course, he was long gone. I went back up to my computer and looked at what I'd been writing. The scene was no good because it was just a bunch of ideas. I could see that clearly now. The fact is that I was that most useless of creatures, a writer obsessed by Jesus, and suspicious of him. I don't mean like Flannery O'Connor. She was obsessed with writing good stories, and Jesus often turned up in them. I was just obsessed with Jesus, period. Jesus and guilt. And to what end? I wouldn't have known Jesus if he knocked at my front door, and I had never faced guilt in my entire life, except that one time when I prayed Beverly LaPlante to death. Otherwise, I was an innocent, really. My wife would understand. What the scene in my novel dramatized was my own obsession and my failure to understand. It was all meaningless. Life, too, was meaningless. All hopeless. Perhaps I had begun to fit in after all. For a long time, I sat in front of my computer, lying to myself. Then I highlighted the whole manuscript and pressed delete. 3. The substance of things hoped for. Here's another one, the EMT said. White male, 80. C'est moi, I thought. Echo me quoi. I was full of thought, some of them rational. My wife had called 911 because I was stuck lying crossways on the bed, my head and shoulders hanging off one side and my legs, from the knees down, hanging off the other. I was unable to move and she was unable to move me. You're burning up, she said, her hand on my forehead. I asked her to give me a couple of hours and I'd figure it out. But she said, this is a mess. This has gone too far. We can't exist like this. And she called 911. The EMTs came and said, where is he? And it's a good thing you called, and everything's going to be fine. The youngest one looked around and said, I've never seen so many books. What was he, a professor or something? What is he, I mean? My wife led the way upstairs and said, lift him carefully. He's got Parkinson's. How you doing? The young one asked, and I told him, fabulous. So they put me in the ambulance and drove me to the hospital, 3 miles exactly, at a cost of $1,700. But that came later. Right now the ambulance was pulling into the loading dock. Here's another one, the EMT said. White male, 80. What's his story? Pneumonia, most likely. High fever, trouble breathing. Can't really move. I can move. But you couldn't when we picked you up. Where's my wife? White male, 80, they passed me down the line and parked me against a wall in a big room. There were a lot of other people on gurneys, and I was happy to see them, but somebody pulled a curtain around me, and that was that. So, I was the thing labeled male, white, 80, a nameless commodity that had something wrong with it. I was not me. Outside my curtain, someone was crying quietly, and someone else, the doctor maybe, was saying, it's all right, it's going to be all right. I was back in third grade thinking, this is wrong, it's untrue, nothing is going to be all right. Still, I understood that the doctor, like Miss Connolly, meant well. Then there was some time I can't account for. Maybe things happened. Maybe I failed to imagine them. I was aware only that my hands were freezing and my head was on fire. My wife was there, and then she was not there. A woman pulled the curtains open and said, I'm your nurse, I'm Tiffany. She was in her early 20s and she wore her hair pulled back tight against her skull, and she bristled with efficiency. Name, she said, date of birth, and then rapidly, residence, what day is it, what is the date? I passed the first test easily. I knew who I was, and when I was born, and where I lived, but I couldn't remember the day or the date. She seemed to take it personally. You don't know the day? Where's my wife? She can't see you now. Why not? Is she here? You're here for pneumonia, she said, so there'll be an X-ray and a CT scan. I have Parkinson's, I said. Whatever, she said. She went away, clackety-clack. Now that I'm retired and just read all day, I'm not good with time. When she asked me what day it was, I thought of that cartoon, the one with the two hippopotamuses up to their chins in water, and one says to the other, I keep thinking it's Tuesday. Of course, if I had said that, they'd have put me in the crazy ward. I'd been there 5 or 6 years earlier after I made an attempt at suicide. 36 Ambien and a handful of Xanax, and the effect the next day was not death, but a bad headache and a very sore throat. Plus 2 weeks locked up with my kind of people. Like me, they thought they wanted to cease being a burden on someone they loved. I had fallen getting out of the bathtub. Zip, slip, and I was down. 3 broken ribs. When they healed, I could no longer draw a deep breath, and I couldn't stop trying. It was like being smothered slowly, over and over and over. For 3 weeks I went around gasping. Exhaustion. Panic attacks. Once in the middle of the night when I was pretending to sleep, I heard my wife sobbing quietly and I realized I was driving her crazy. I was killing her. So without a thought for Jesus, or even Beverly LaPlante, I decided to kill myself instead. Hence the Ambien and the Xanax. And then the lockdown in the company of my fellow suiciders. Afterward, I told my wife I was sorry. And she said, "If you ever try that again, I'll kill you myself." My wife. You have to know her to understand. She's a genuine saint. The real thing without any pious crap. So she's not always easy to live with. She was not a saint when we first married. She had her faults, plenty of them, I thought at the time. But she was beautiful and smart and funny. And she considered me interesting, so who could resist? Later, after she had rubbed some of the rough edges off me, I began to see her differently. Or maybe she changed, I don't know. But I became aware of that glow from inside her that nothing could dim, not even sickness or frustration, or my occasional rage and jealousy, things that made her sad, not angry. Hers was an everyday kind of sanctity. She had an unnerving fondness for the truth, and knowing her made you want to be a better person. Saints are not the easiest companions. After my suicide attempt, immediately after, I lost my obsessions and began to enjoy life. It was as if I had died and come back a different person, free of all that nonsense. I had always been afraid of living, but I wasn't any longer, and I wasn't afraid of Jesus. Moreover, if she had still been around, I wouldn't have been afraid of Beverly LaPlante. I was that self-confident. So life was good, and its nasty surprises didn't seem so nasty anymore, not even the Parkinson's. It happened slowly. My left hand began to shake when I was typing, but I was in the final draft of a new book, and until it was done I just ignored the shakes, corrected the errors, and finished my work. Then I took my shaky hand to Dr. Byrne. "A familial tremor," he said, "not Parkinson's." "Familial tremor," my wife said. "At least it's not the dread disease itself." A year later, I was shaking more and walking in a half-assed kind of stumble. So we went back to Dr. Byrne, who said, "Let's see a neurologist." The neurologist was Dr. Gershfield, and he knew everything. Gershfield said, "It's not, strictly speaking, Parkinson's. It's Parkinsonism." "Ism?" "Yes, Parkinsonism." "Well," my wife said, "I'm glad we cleared that up." Then we all had a friendly Parkinsonian laugh. We saw him again in a month, and then every month for a year, by which time I was half in love with him, and so was my wife. After all, like Jesus, he had the power to dispense life and death. There was a long night when they woke me every hour to check on me. Toward morning they took another chest x-ray and a fresh CT scan of my lungs. I fell back asleep, and in no time it was, "Wakeys!" Tiffany stood by my bed at the ready. I said, "Good morning," but she was too busy for that. She nodded and went about taking my vitals. "I keep thinking it's Tuesday," I said. "It is Tuesday," she said. "Very good." One hippopotamus says to the other, "I keep thinking it's Tuesday." "It is Tuesday," she said. "Stop worrying." The ceiling was spinning again. I thought I couldn't move because of the Parkinson's. "We'll get that pneumonia under control by tomorrow. You can take that to the bank." I laughed and said, "Take that to the bank. It's a saying," she said, and off she went, ka-chung, ka-chung. My wife came every day, morning and afternoon. She read a book while I slept and tried to make conversation when I woke, but I wasn't making a lot of sense, and naturally she was bored to death. Even saints get bored, waiting. Maybe saints especially. A doctor with a clipboard poked his head around the door. "Just checking," he said. "It's Tuesday," I said. "Are you in great pain?" "I'm not in any pain at all. I'm a male, white 80. "I can see that," he said. "You look about 14, I said. He wrote something on his clipboard. I was hot and drowsy and a little dizzy. "No pain," he said. "You sure?" I needed to explain to him the limitations of being just a white male, etc., but I couldn't find the words. I was feeling lightheaded, and the ceiling kept spinning as if I were drunk. "I'm not drunk," I said. "You're a riot," he said. "Hold on to that sense of humor." Some time went by, maybe an hour or maybe a day, and another doctor appeared, a woman this time. She said, "Tiffany says you're concerned about Parkinson's, But your problem at present is pneumonia. You're on 2 antibiotics, that's the drip bags on your left. And your fever should be under control in another day. Maybe 2. Then you can go home. Do you have any questions? So I'm being cured of pneumonia? Well, we can't cure Parkinson's, yet. But the paralysis was caused by pneumonia? I've never heard of such a thing. Nevertheless. What's your name, I said, just so I know. Janet, she said. I mean, what's your last name? Dr. What? There was a long pause. We're here to make you well, not to make new friends. And she took off. So it was pneumonia and not Parkinson's that had me momentarily paralyzed. Talk about a downer. I would never have come to the hospital if I'd known it was pneumonia. My wife wouldn't have called 911. The plan had been to let pneumonia carry me off before Parkinson's had its final fling with me. If you're going to die anyway, we had agreed, better to do it before you begin to shake all day, and your voice melts, and maybe your mind as well. I had had 3 bouts of pneumonia in the past year, so we were planning on having one ready when the time came. One night, as we were winding up a long chat about whether we could count on pneumonia to do it, or whether we'd have to face the horrors of death by Parkinson's, my wife yawned and said, "Maybe you'll be lucky, sweetheart. Maybe you'll get run over by a truck." My fever was gone and I was feeling terrific. The 14-year-old doctor turned up after breakfast to say that the X-ray and the CT scan were fine, but they had revealed an unexplained mass in my left lung. "A mass of what?" I said. "Very funny," he said, "but this is a serious matter, and you ought to take it up with a specialist." "A mass of stuff?" I said. "What kind of stuff?" "At the least, you'll be prone to frequent bouts of pneumonia, deep pneumonia." I said, "I knew it. I've always been lucky." "Do you have any other questions?" he said. "How old are you?" I said. "Keep up the good work," he said. "Keep smiling." He left the room without saying goodbye. So, a mass in my lungs. He hadn't used the C word, but what else could a mass be? Lung cancer. Consider it. Cancer of the lungs. It didn't sound so bad, really. Maybe this was the truck that would run me over before Parkinson's had its final fling, before the drooling set in. So now we had 2 possible escape routes, pneumonia and cancer. Which would be first? Which would be less painful, I wondered. And then a surge of relief as I realized that cancer or pneumonia, my wife would be there, and good old Dr. Byrne would refer me to palliative care, maybe with my own little bottle of morphine. I was looking forward to this choice of deaths, and I couldn't wait to tell my wife. A momentary pause, a catch in my breath. "What happened to that boy doctor?" I asked the empty room. "And what about Tiffany?" Nobody answered. A bell rang. A door slammed. Tiffany appeared and said, "You're being discharged today. You'll sign papers at the desk. Your wife is here. Still." She wheeled my bed tray into a corner and pushed the visitor's chair out of her way and marched off to bring order and efficiency to other lives. Her heels clacked annoyance as she went. A year passed, and my balance grew more shaky, my walk became a stagger, and my voice was reduced to an unsympathetic whine. My wife took all this to heart, and just for companionship, she whined along with me now and then. But mostly she took care of me, as if attendance on a half-dead white male, 80, was really fun and just what she had been hoping for in life. Over the year, we had become closer and closer. We had gradually become one person. Or maybe 2 persons in one being, as Aquinas would say. We had transubstantiated and become a problem in philosophy or theology. But it was getting late, and where was the pneumonia, we wanted to know? Where was the cancer? The cancer had turned out to be a benign tumor with little promise, though we tried to hurry it along with prayers and good works. So for now, pneumonia had become our only hope. We saw friends and went out to dinner and carried on with our crooked life. All around us, people were coughing and wheezing and saying they couldn't stand this flu, they wished they were dead. And here we were, waiting on just one little pneumonia bug to do its work. Then there it was. We were watching television, Judge Judy to be exact, when suddenly I went cold. Not all over, just in my hands and feet. My head was hot and grew hotter, and my hands grew colder. and I tried to stand, but I couldn't move. "This is it," I said, "or at least I think so." My wife said, "Oh God, no." She tried to help me off the couch, but paralyzed, I weighed a ton and she had to give up. "Never mind," I said, "but don't call 911. So we just sat together on the couch, two old people wrapped in each other's arms. Mobility returns and you help me to my bed. A day goes by and then another. You pray to know what to do, but we have long since agreed to do nothing, so that's what we do. I say I'll miss you when I'm dead. And in a while there comes the final moment. The earth stops spinning and a luminous silence descends. And then as we draw one last breath together, I snatch your hand and hold it, holding it and holding it, and still holding it, I breathe out. Still, I'll miss you when I'm dead.
That was John Lurer reading his story, Three Short Moments in a Long Life. His novel, The Medici Boy, was just published in paperback. You can hear more New Yorker fiction read by the authors on NewYorker.com and on the New Yorker app, available from the App Store or from Google Play. If you enjoyed this program, you may also enjoy the New Yorker Fiction Podcast, which features New Yorker fiction writers reading and discussing stories from the magazine's archive. This month, Dana Spiota reads Chicken Hill by Joy Williams. You can subscribe to that and other New Yorker podcasts by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app. The weekly audio edition of The New Yorker is available on iTunes or Audible.com. Tell us what you thought of this podcast by rating and reviewing the author's voice on iTunes. Our theme music is by Jordan Batiste and Ross Michaels of North American Plastics. The author's voice is produced by Jill Duboff and Alex Barron of NewYorker.com. I'm Deborah Treisman. Thanks for listening.